The Murthy law firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion to talk about the basics of the perm. We are delighted and honored to have you, and I'm delighted to introduce two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy law firm. Jim McLaughlin, who's been at the firm, I don't even know how long. Jim, maybe you'll tell us, but I always know everybody's been there for such a long time, and we have such bright, talented, smart people helping, guiding, mentoring our clients. And we have Jeffrey Galkin, who is equally sharp, brilliant, eager to help you and your employers, as employers and your employees through the perm process. So, of course, most of you who are familiar with this know what the perm means. It's the first of the three-stage process towards permanent residency in cases where there is an employer involved, what we call employment-based immigration. For certain employment-based categories, the INA or the Immigration and Nationality Act requires as a prerequisite that the employer must demonstrate that sponsoring the foreign national will not adversely affect the wages and the working conditions for the American labor market. And in order to do this, the employer must have the U.S. Department of Labor certify that the labor market was properly tested. So there are lots of technical nuances, stuff that most normal people wouldn't think of in the real world, but you have to dot the I's and cross the T's. And no one better to be able to discuss those issues than Jim McLaughlin and Jeffrey Galkin, who do this more day in and day out, right? So we need to talk a little bit about the prevailing wage. We need to talk about the, that there are no willing, qualified U.S. workers able to fill that particular job or fill that position. So Jim, let me invite you to jump in and talk about determining the perm position requirements.
Sure. Thanks, Sheila. And yeah, I'm going on 15 years now, so it's been a while. The first step, once you start a labor certification or the perm process, you need to determine what the position is that you're actually sponsoring the individual in. And while there's lots of delays in the process and stages with the Department of Labor, this is really the cornerstone for the whole case. You're building it with, based upon ideally what you as the employer require as a minimum requirement for the job. The Department of Labor doesn't accept preferences. You can't use that. Consistency is key, and there's always a chance of an audit where the Department of Labor is going to come back and look at it. So everything rests on what you're doing right here at the very beginning stage. Now, there's what you do in the real world, right? In the real world, you interview somebody. You don't like the way they come across in the interview. You don't like something about their resume. You know, you can disqualify them, but that's not what's happening here in the perm process. You're really talking with the minimum requirements for the job, you're talking about what you require as a basic minimum requirement. It's not the best person to perform the job. It's almost in a way the lowest common denominator. What do you need for somebody to do this job? Even if they can't do it as well as somebody else, what's that minimum? And that's what you're working from. Now, in the perm process, the employee is going to be part of this, right? They're going to have to give documentation to show that they meet the requirements for the job, and they're always going to be thinking about sort of the end result for them when they get the green card. Now, what determines how long somebody's waiting typically is what category the job that you said the minimum requirements are fall into, whether it's EB2 preference category or an EB3 preference category. EB2 generally requires higher credentials, a master's degree or bachelor's in 5. Anything less than that would be an EB3. So this is something that you're going to be conversing with your employee about and something you want to be aware of. Historically, EB2 is a little faster than EB3. If you were born in India, there's not too much difference. It kind of leapfrog back and forth between the two. But despite what your employee may want as an employer, just be thinking about, okay, what is it that I need as a minimum requirement understanding that you want to be consistent, because it's really going to come up throughout the entire stage of the process and if you do labor certifications in the future.
Okay, thank you, Jim. And so I guess, you know, I know at one point almost every consultation would start with the employer, and more than even often than the employer, would the employee would say, well, I wanted to get an EB2 because that was like the ticket, the magic ticket to jump, or to like to use Jim's phrase, leapfrog the process and get it faster. But now because everybody in the world became EB2, EB3 at one point became faster. So it seems to go yin and yang from one side to the other. But from a practical point of view, I guess, Jeffrey, I'll invite you to jump in now, is to say, is there a problem if we try to up the requirements to fit into the EB2 category instead of the EB3?
So it's a very important question and a very common question. And higher requirements are not necessarily an issue, but there are certain issues that could come up when an employer does try to raise the minimum requirements just to be an EB2. And for one, and Jim touched upon this, that the position has to represent the actual minimum requirements that the employer has for the position. So if a position typically requires a bachelor's degree and 2 years of experience, then if for an employer to suddenly say, well, now for this process, we're going to require a bachelor's degree and 5 years of experience just to make it EB2, well, that would not be a good faith representation of the minimum requirements. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is that there are times that the Department of Labor can consider the employer's minimum requirements to be too high for the occupation. And just a brief background about this, every position is classified as a certain occupation by the U.S. Department of Labor. Each occupation is placed in one of four job zones. And each job zone is assigned a specific amount of vocational preparation, or SVP, which the Department of Labor considers normal for that occupation. So if an employer has minimum requirements for a position that exceed that SVP, then it is possible that in the face of an audit, the employer is going to have to demonstrate that there is a business necessity to justify those higher minimum requirements for the position. So that's a second potential issue. Now, the third is that the employee who is being sponsored for the position has to qualify for the position that's being used. And if an employer has minimum requirements that are too high or higher than what the employee meets with the employee's credentials, then that will be an issue because the employee won't qualify for the position that the employer wants the employee working in. And let's say in the example of a bachelor's degree and 5 years of experience to qualify for EB2, if the employee only has 3 years of experience, then that will be an issue. There are times when an employee can use the experience gained with the sponsoring employer to qualify for the sponsored position. There are some risks to that, though, because there are really only two. The Department of Labor doesn't really like it when that type of experience is being used. There are two exceptions. One is where the experience gained with the sponsoring employer is more than 50% different or substantially different than the job duties for the position being used, or the employer can demonstrate that it is no longer feasible to train a worker to qualify for the position and therefore needs to fall back on the job experience that the employee has.
Right. And I just, if you don't mind, I just wanted to highlight, again, like what you were saying, Jeff, make sure that for employers, make sure your employee can document what it is you're saying that you require. In the real world, you don't have to necessarily, an employee puts something on their resume and you say, oh, okay, you work with this. Great. That's exactly what we're looking for. But in this process, you can't just use an employee's resume. You need an experience letter or a colleague affidavit. So something to keep in mind when you're drafting what the requirements are for this job, and be consistent. And something else in reference to what you were saying, Jeff, is, you know, what the Department of Labor considers normal. For many job zone normal professional positions, normal to DOL is a bachelor's and 2 years of experience. So that's pretty low. If somebody's been working in the field for a little while, they may not be at the very highest point of their career, but they certainly, what they're doing requires more than a bachelor's in two. So keep in mind, there's also that DOL point of view, which the farther you get from what they consider normal, the potentially greater chance of audit.
Great, great discussion. Great point. So, with respect to the first formal step, because previously this used to take just a few weeks, a couple months, now it could take 6 to 8 months. The first formal step of the firm process is to submit the PWD, or the prevailing wage determination, to the DOL, the U.S. Department of Labor. And this is based on the position detail, the geographic area, because different parts of the country salaries tend to be different based on the cost of living index, et cetera. And so the wage will be the minimum wage that the employer must offer for the position during this recruitment stage, and also the minimum wage that the sponsored employee must be paid upon receipt of the green card. So it's not something that has to be paid on day one, because as you know, sometimes green card could take decades to get finally approved. So what are these wages? So prevailing wages are determined by the DOL, Department of Labor, based on the position requirements, job duties. So generally it's levels 1 to 4, right? So a wage can be on one of the four levels for the particular occupation, and the assignment of the wage level depends on the relationship that we've mentioned, that we just went over this analysis of the education and the experience, compared to the normal range that is assigned by the particular job zone, with higher requirements obviously requiring a higher wage. So if you add, for example, travel or special skills or supervisory requirements, that's going to again increase the salary or the minimum PWD. So the employer can try to use an alternate wage survey if it comes back unrealistically high, because a lot of companies will say, sorry, that's not within my range, I'm not willing to proceed, discontinue the firm altogether, and you could end up losing a year or longer, and that could be critical if you're towards the end of your 6 years on H-1 and you don't have an I-140 approval. So then the employer could try to use an AWS or alternate wage survey, not based on the Department of Labor data, to try to get a lower wage, but this also ultimately has to be accepted by the Department of Labor. And if the position is actually with a CBA or collective bargaining agreement, then this must be submitted to the Department of Labor, which generally gives that a lot of weight because they know that unions and collective bargaining agreement wages tend to be actually generally higher, not always, but fairly often. And so if as an employer, you disagree with the wage determination, what are your options? Well, you can first request a redetermination. If that is unsuccessful, you could request a director's review. And if that too is unsuccessful, then you, as the employer, could appeal to the BALCA, or Board of Alien Labor Certification Appeals. But given the length of these review processes, sometimes and most often it is actually faster to submit a new prevailing wage request with adjustments to the position to ensure that you get the wage you're looking for, unless, again, strategically you're trying to do that to get H-1 extensions or other strategic reasons, and you know you're investing time, effort, energy to try to buy time so you can get your one-year H-1 extensions while all of this process is going on. Okay, yeah. Next, let's jump into what's called the labor market test/recruitment, because after PWD, that's the next phase. Jim?
Right, exactly. And I'd just like to add that to what you were saying. For the redetermination request, the prevailing wage comes back. As the employer, you have to file within 30 days. So you have to move kind of quickly. And generally with those redeterminations, you're either going to have alternative wage survey, or you're basically arguing that the Department of Labor miscategorized the position, or the analysis of what the wage levels are. Anything short of that, there really wouldn't be a reason for redetermination. So you may have to go back to the drawing board. But just something to keep in mind. Obviously, talk to your attorney, whoever's working with it, to figure out the best approach with you. Now,
and if you have the best law firm in the world, you won't have to worry if you have anybody.
That's right. You may have already discussed this even before filing the prevailing wage if you're with the Murphy Law Firm. But so you've already determined what the job is. You've now obtained your prevailing wage determination, and you can proceed with it. It's acceptable wage, right category, all of that. Now you have to do the labor market test. Now, there's always exceptions where you might start the labor market test before you get the prevailing wage, but that's kind of outside the scope of this short recording, but it's certainly something to keep in mind if you need to talk about that with your attorney. Now, with the labor market test, what you're doing is you are determining whether there are any minimally qualified U.S. workers willing and able to perform the duties of the job. And you have to test the labor market because this whole process is about protecting U.S. workers, right? And so you have to keep that in mind. That's what the Department of Labor is looking for. For all positions, there are certain ads that are all the same, whether it's a professional or non-professional job. So you've got your Sunday ads, you've got your internal notice of posting, and your state workforce agency ad. That's the same for everybody. If it's a professional position, then there's three additional forms of recruitment you have to utilize. The PERM regulations give you a list of various options, local paper, company ad, employee referral program, such as recruiter. There's lots of different options. So you can basically determine what works best for you or what more matches what you typically do for how you hire a candidate. You know, obviously this may, what they're asking you to do may be more than we do in the real world, but it's the minimum requirement from the Department of Labor. Now, when you actually get a resume from an individual, you're taking a look at that resume. If they appear they may be qualified for the position, you need to go through a normal recruitment process. You have to see, does that person meet the requirements, the education, the experience? Are they willing to work for the position as offered? The terms of employment, you know, the location, the hours, the job duties, willing to travel or relocate as required. They're willing to accept the salary. And there's a whole sort of layout and process that you have to go as an employer, making sure that you're dotting every I and crossing every T so that you can build that compliance file in case there is an audit on the case, and you can show the Department of Labor that you've done everything you need to. Now, assuming you don't find any qualified U.S. workers, then you can file that application with the Department of Labor.
Okay, Jim. So once the case is filed, how does that work? Jeffrey, I'm going to have you jump in. What kind of form? How does the process work? What happens after the I-140? The PERM is, you know, filed, hopefully approved. What does it mean to do the I-140? Just a quick 1 or 2 minute overview, since we're trying to keep this within 20 to 30 minutes, and I think we're doing great on time.
So, yeah, and as Jim just said, so you're going to file that form 9089 with the Department of Labor. That is the PERM application, or, you know, people call it various things, but it takes around 15 months right now to process, maybe even a little more sometimes. But once it's approved, then the employer can file the I-140 petition. Now, that is with USCIS. We're moving from the Department of Labor to USCIS, and that is where the employer confirms that the job offer to be the basis of the employee's future green card process. There are two things that the I-140 petition does immediately, and in addition to just forming the basis of the green card process. Number one, it locks in the employee's priority date, which I'll circle back to in a minute. And number two, an approved I-140 provides the basis for additional H-1B extensions, three-year H-1B extensions, beyond the six-year cap on the H-1B period. Now, ultimately, the employee's priority date needs to become current in order for the employee to apply for a green card. The United States is only allowed to issue a certain amount of green cards each year, and each country is subject to a per-country cap. And the priority date essentially becomes the employee's ticket number in their country's queue for when a green card is available and for when the employee can apply for a green card.
Excellent, excellent points. And I think when people keep asking, you know, I'm coming to you guys with only 1 year remaining on my 6 years H-1B, big problem, because like you said, it takes 4, 6, 8 months to get the prevailing wage, another 15 months to get this. You're going to have to pack up and leave the country, and it's going to be a problem. And people are like, no, that can't be. You have to find a solution, and the solution is start early, so we won't be dealing with this panic and fear and concern about having to sell your house or pack up or move out with your family or go to another country. So as you can see from this discussion, PERM is a highly, highly technical process. many details that can create potential traps for employers and employees. So be smart, be proactive, be diligent, and don't wait till the last minute, obviously. And if you as the employer will approach the process with the right perspective, hopefully work with a knowledgeable law firm like the Mulsey Law Firm that can actually guide you and not come back to you after 2 years saying, whoops, which is what happens in almost every case that we get is the lawyer messed up, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, they forgot to file, they didn't understand how the process works. Now I have a year remaining because I lost 2 years and now you need to pull a rabbit out of a hat and do some magic for us. I tell them the world's best doctor cannot cure a dead patient, right? But with the right legal guidance, the right team on your side, we can take great care of you as the employer or the employee. And we could continue the discussion, but we want to be somewhat brief and give you the quick overview. So on behalf of Jim McLaughlin, Jeffrey Galkin, myself, Sheila Mulsey, and the entire Mulsey Law Firm team, thank you so much for joining us for today's quick overview on the Perm and I-140 process. We look forward to taking great care of you as the employer or as the employee or both, hopefully, and have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Mulsey Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.